A poll from the Pew Center confirms what we were already sensing, the deepest political divide in the United States in the last 25 years, maybe all the way back to the Civil War. We have a diagnosis today, maybe even a prescription or two. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The number to join the conversation, 1-800-478-8255. A local call on Anchorage, 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. The author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, our guest today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, it's been a while getting to the point of doing this program, and I'm very happy to introduce to our listeners Jonathan Haidt of the New York University and the author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
And also with me is Kirk Carnes. He's the executive presbyter of the Presbytery of Yukon and a participant in the One People, One Earth Project. Kirk?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So, John, I you mentioned a couple of times in your book you're an atheist, right?
Yes, I am.
And, Kurt, you're a man of the cloth.
I am.
So... already, we're stepping into that territory that you were talking about people being divided by politics and religion.
Well, my guess is that we're not. My guess is that actually Kurt and I would get along just fine because it's not the religion divide, actually, I think, is not as steep as the politics divide. People on the left, so American history was always divided by religion from the days of the founders on. But what happened in the last 30, 40 years is that the liberal Catholics and liberal Jews and liberal Protestants all lined up on one side along with the atheists. Whereas the conservatives of each religion lined up. So actually, nowadays, it really is politics much more than religion that is dividing us.
Well, what do you think of someone like Kurt here, who is, I guess you would call him a liberal, but he'd probably say mainline, and who is coming to us with a stewardship message? Where does that fall on the spectrum? I mean, it seems that it's a more fundamentalist culturally conservative churches that seem to be the ones that are always telling people how to live.
Well, first of all, the one thing that you told me about Kurt was that he is from a group called One People, One Earth. So that's pretty perfectly diagnostic of being left of center. Liberals tend to be much more universalist. Conservatives are more parochial, which is not a bad thing. Parochial just means they're more concerned with local stuff, with their neighborhood, their state, their nation.
Uh-huh.
So that's the one thing that I know about Kurt. And in response to what you said about how it's the conservatives who are telling people how to live, well, ask conservatives what they think of my mayor here in New York, Mayor Bloomberg, telling them what they can eat, what size soda they can buy. Each side wants the world to live the way it wants the world to live, and it's going to tell them how to do that.
What is up with that? What is it? This is so nanny state, I can't believe it.
I know. It is kind of offensive. This is, I think, one of the problems. So let me just state clearly. I'm a centrist. I like to criticize both sides. I find wisdom on both sides, so don't get me wrong here. But my finding in my research, and I do a lot of research at my website, yourmorals.org, is that liberal morality tends to rest primarily on concerns about care, compassion, harm, suffering, those sorts of things. And if that's what morality is, if it's sort of a one foundation morality based on protecting people, and you see the numbers, you see that obesity causes terrible suffering, early death, So, well, we've got to protect people from hurting themselves, and those evil soda manufacturers are going to lure them in. So if that's all morality is, well, then it makes sense. Logically, it makes sense. Let's ban the things that are most fattening. But if morality is more than that, and you say, well, okay, you want to tell people what to do? This is America. One of our big values here is personal responsibility and individual liberty. You don't tell people what to do unless they're hurting someone else. So I think that's the heart of the conflict right there.
John, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I enjoy the thought that has gone into your work and the integrity of the research that you've done to find the really a biological and evolutionary base for morality. That's quite an accomplishment there.
Well, thanks. I've been working on it 25 years, and this is my report, so I'm glad you're giving it a good review.
I won't say that necessarily I think that you're right, but...
Okay, well, let's get into it.
Yeah, well, okay. You were... it seems likely that there is such a thing as a moral intuition. I mean, a person can observe that in themselves.
Yep.
And it's easy to think of some evolutionary theories that, you know, go back like, you know, maybe 100,000 years and more. That's certainly enough time for things to get encoded in the genes.
That's correct.
And so one can, you know, as Durkheim, you know, who you lean on quite a bit, as Durkheim has analyzed, there can be real good reasons when you go back and think of people as living in tribes and so forth for there being some types of moral inclinations that might become something different in our present day society, and you know, especially the one, let's do the real simple one of free riders, I think you call them.
Yes, that's right. It's a very, very helpful concept. So, so my book is based on, well, there are three parts to it, but the central part, the middle part, is on how there are these six different foundations of morality. And I try to make the case that each of them is innate, each of them is a product of evolution, but that they're just like the taste buds. They're a feature of our perception. We perceive unfairness, we perceive disloyalty, we perceive disrespect, just as we might perceive sweet and sour and salt and bitter. So we perceive these things, and they motivate us to behave in certain ways that protect ourselves, but that often protect our groups. And what a lot of our culture war is about nowadays, since the Tea Party, what a lot of it is about who's cheating, who is getting benefits without putting in, without making a contribution. And so the Tea Party started in response to the bank bailouts. It started in response to these financial firms that ripped us all off, took gambles with other people's money, and when the gambles came out bad, they wanted a bailout, and were given it. So this is an outrage, and what we find is that conservatives tend to be more outraged by this kind of unfairness. Liberals, nobody likes it, but liberals are, because they care more about compassion, so let's take the case of health care. If an illegal immigrant comes to America and then is in a car accident, what should happen? Well, if you're a liberal, you think, oh my God, you can't just let a person die, you've got to take care of them. And if you're a conservative, a social conservative, you're at least more likely to say, well, they broke the law, it's their own fault, they should have thought of that. So this is at least a lot of our current divide is, should we be compassionate or should we be strict with people who are receiving benefits without having earned them?
And to get back to Durkheim, what was going on is you have a group of people like long ago, and they find an advantage in cooperative endeavors as opposed to everybody going their own way. I mean, there would be good reasons because... You have to raise children. The children don't just come popping out with all sorts of instincts, and there's a lot of reasons, really, to work cooperatively that might generate an advantage and even an inclination. And but you do get this situation where some are going to be freeloaders,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
so it's pretty, you know, So there has to be somebody that comes along and says, no, you can't do that.
That's right. And that's so the third part of my book, the basic principle there is morality binds and blinds. Morality binds us into moral communities where we can suppress free riding and reap the benefits of cooperation. And that's what I quote the great French sociologist Émile Durkheim, who was the master at seeing the internal and invisible order of societies and what it takes to hold a society together, and just how miraculous it is that we can actually cooperate pretty well with people that are not our family. Yes, liberal societies tend to be they'll sort of dole out benefits. They'll be in the name of compassion, often too far. And then you know sometimes you kind of need someone. You kind of need like a yin yang balance. You need Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher to come in and say, well, this has gone too far. This is sapping our work ethic. This is draining the treasury. Obviously, Reagan drained the treasury in many other ways. He didn't exactly reduce the deficit. He increased it. But in terms of the welfare state that the Democrats were setting up in the 60s and 70s, I think they were going too far on some matters. And, you kind of need to go back and forth between the two parties.
And this business of this inclination that there would actually be an inclination, we go back so many generations, that there actually is an inclination in people towards disciplining freeloaders.
That's
a fairness, I think you call it. And you actually derive tests that can show this. And you've also derived experiments and gone back in history and shown examples where this works. There's an evolutionary advantage in this inclination to wrap the knuckles of the freeloader.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big revelation, because this is not, you know, this don't exactly fit in the caring liberal thing.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think if you just let liberals run everything, then things tend to kind of fall apart. Now, if you let conservatives run everything and have no liberal influence, then I think things tend to get a little too harsh. People who don't fit in, people who get sick through no fault of their own, many of those people will be ignored. This is why I think you do need a balance of liberal and conservative. Let's talk about religion here. Let's bring in Kurt. I think the voice I've been hearing all along has been Steve's. Is that right? Has Kurt been talking?
Or? That's right, but he's ready to mix it up.
I'm here,
okay,
yeah.
Great. Oh, great. Okay, Kurt, so let's bring you in. So what do you think about the role of religion in creating moral communities where you suppress free riders and you get everybody contributing? I mean, there's some arguments that I cover in the book about how this is part of what religions evolved to do, is to bind groups together around sacred objects. And when we circle around sacred objects and worship the same gods, we then trust each other. And we have a set of moral rules, and be it from the Golden Rule to the Ten Commandments, which we can enforce on each other. And the net effect, it might seem to restrict people's individual liberty, but boy, it helps them work together and reap the benefits of cooperation. That's my view of religion. What do you see as the essential role of religion in shaping society?
Well, religion is it certainly plays the roles that you're saying. Part of what does happen, of course, is that people discover as they are trying to describe the sense of the sacred that they have, and they find ways of describing that. They also then need ways of honoring the sacred, and in honoring that, they do, of course, come up with ways of determining what is God revealing as the way of life, and how do we enforce helping people to live according to that. But you end up within the religious folks then some of the same dialogue that you see in society. You know, how harsh should we be in disciplining people of different views? How much of a breadth of view is allowed within a religious body before you finally say, you know, that's too far? And that becomes part of the whole issue that happens within religion. But a big part of what religion does is it creates ways of people bonding together, as you said, and bonding together is hugely important to society. It also creates ways in which people of different viewpoints can come together and can can live with one another. The previous church I served was in North Pole, Alaska, and we had a number of Democrats and Republicans and people who are theologically conservative and theologically liberal within that church. We ended up having to say, how do we get these people to work together? You know, that's it's a big issue. We are together because we serve God, and the Bible is our guide. But we find ourselves within this Christian family arguing about the Bible. It becomes this family discussion.
Right.
And
right. So
you're having this family discussion, but you're having a hard time. So it's easy to retreat into camps and polarize.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we ended up doing was actually using something called the World Cafe to bring people together. And we had to go out, the leaders, and actually, you know, recruit people and say, we want you to be at this table because your voice is needed because you're different.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would come, and they felt like they had a role to play. And what we found was, as we talked together, the relationships would build, and they would find common ground. And then the ministry would build traction on that common ground that they found together. And that's one of the roles that religion can also play, is it causes us to not demonize one another, but it does require that we establish certain boundaries that say, what are we together for? And religion helps
that's
with
right.
that.
Well, that's wonderful. Those are really great examples of you know, a lot of the things I'm talking about in the book, how as long as you have a sense of being members of a common group, you have a common group identity, you all worship the same God, I assume you literally sat down at tables, and I presume you had some food or drink at the tables?
Well, we did, but you know, that's a cultural thing. And so we did, but when I took this to an indigenous group in a different part of the state, they were pretty clear, no food or drink. If you're having a serious conversation, you don't do that around food and drink. But
oh, that's interesting.
But in a more Anglo-American group, the food and drink set the stage like be sitting in a cafe together. It was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right.
You know,
well,
it's...
There's some very deep psychological principles, like breaking bread. When you share food with someone, or you play on the same team as them, or you worship the same God, that's just really going to pull for opening your mind because it opens your heart.
Yeah,
and
well,
so
and
sounds,
when you say
you describe some conditions under which you were able to get more agreement. And cross some divides. I just want to make the point that you know Steve opened with, "Hey, Height's an atheist, and you know, and Kurt, you know, Kurt's religious. Therefore, they're going to be divided,
and we're going to mix it up." He said,
because,
"Right?
yeah, because you know, I was raised Jewish, and you know, growing up in the '60s and '70s, I had a sense that it's a basically Christian country. But my parents told me America is the promised land for the Jews because Jews were welcomed here and basically left alone to be successful. So I've you know, growing up in this country, I felt as though Christians weren't going to try to convert me. They didn't hate me. We could live next door to each other. And you know, you and your fellow Christians might have to have this family discussion about theological questions. But if I'm a Jew next door, You don't have to agree with me about that. We just have to agree to respect each other, live alongside each other, and give each other a bit of room. And that generally works pretty well in this country.
Mm. One people,
yes,
one earth.
What do you think?
I want to try and broaden it out with Kurt here to this one people, one earth. Because while you tended to kind of pigeonhole it, John, as a kind of a liberal thing, I don't think that's the way that Kurt is looking at it. And I would say this. In the 1970s, when Stephen Schneider started raising the alarm about the possibility that our carbon emissions might actually be harming the planet, you know, mm-hmm. I thought this is going to be a really hard theory to prove, A, and B, mm-hmm. if it is proven, this is going to be one of the most profound moral challenges to humanity
yeah.
ever. And I still think that. And I think this is where Kurt is going with one people, one earth. And what I want to ask you, John, then, is, and you can think about this while Kurt talks a little bit about how, about the stewardship thing, is where is the traction for a type of morality or ethic that looks to the entire world? Kurt, tell me a little bit about stewardship in these meetings that you've been having.
Yeah, One People, One Earth came out of the Alaska chapter of Interfaith Power and Light, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own. And Mary Walker, who is the director of One People, One Earth, gathered us together, and she was working with Interfaith Power and Light in Alaska at that time. And So she drew.
Now we're talking an imam and a priest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a rabbi?
Well, sometimes. There aren't that many rabbis in Alaska. Mm. But so we've. Let me just, I'll get to that in just a moment. Yeah. There were actually three categories. She grew together traditional Native elders, some well-known folks from across the state. She drew together scientists from the University of Alaska, and we tended to draw from scientists in whichever community we were meeting in at the time. The common one there has been Terry Chapin, who's an ecologist who's been working in sustainable ecosystems and sustainable human systems on the planet. And then religious leaders. Now, among the religious leaders, then there was a Protestant, me, a Roman Catholic priest, an imam. And then when we were in Juneau, we had the luxury of also having then Dove Gartner join us, who's a rabbi. And but we came together, and the religious folks are pretty clear that we're from different camps. But at the same time, the overarching issue of how are we going to care for God's planet, especially at this moment in history when carbon emissions and methane emissions are having such a huge impact
on the north,
Right. I mean everywhere, but we see it so strongly in the north. Kivalina, just famously, you know, is one village that has to move because the storms now are washing away. The peninsula, what is it? It's a spit that they're on. And because the ice has disappeared, the winter storms come in before the ice has formed. It's washing them away. Mm. So Alaskans are hugely affected. The permafrost is melting. I talked to people in Anaktuvik Pass. The ice cellars that they put their meat in no longer freeze in the summer. Mm-hmm. And so they're buying freezers. I mean, things are happening rapidly in Alaska. But it's not just Alaska.
So this is a case. So this is a very, very interesting because the moralization, the battle over global warming and carbon emissions, this pits the left, which is very, very concerned about it, against one branch of the right, which is more the business conservatives, the ones who are very concerned about regulation and the free market. Social conservatives. So the thing people need to understand is that the right in America is really composed of two very different groups, psychologically speaking. There are the social conservatives, who care about deeply care about these issues of loyalty, authority, sanctity, religion, and then there are the economic, what we call economic conservatives. But it's a kind of a crazy name because an economic conservative can also be called a classical liberal, someone who believes in freedom, who believes in the free market, and is opposed to government regulation. So the right in this country is an alliance of two very different movements. And I was just asked in an interview I did just before our talk here. I was just asked, well, you know, why don't those conservatives care about conserving the world? And I basically said, well, look, the social conservatives, and especially the young evangelicals, I am mm-hmm. seeing some signs of it. God gave us dominion over the plants and animals in the earth, and I do see signs that many young Christians are concerned about it. So I'm hopeful that they will be speaking up within within communities that generally vote Republican to make their voice heard.
Well, John, one of the things that you bring up in your prescription towards the end of the book, and certainly in your conversation with Bill Moyers, is getting across this growing divide. And we just yesterday, a new Pew report came out that showed this deep division that we all know is there. And what you basically had two things to say to Bill Moyers. One was, we got to do something about the corruption. There's just too much money, and politicians are getting bought. It might not even be in their intentions, but the system is such that they get bought. They got to do something about it. And the other one was, I took this down, capitalism is like a garden. You have to tend it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
As a value that people might find commonality on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right. What I'm thinking, does this lead perhaps to this stewardship thing where if the incentives were right, like Hansen argues that you have 350 and you have a what he calls the carbon dividend, which is, yes, you got to have a government to run it, but at the same time, it's tending capitalism.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So we've got this terrible divide in the country. The people are a little bit further apart than they were 10, 20 years ago, just in that there's more hostility towards, you know, liberals have more hostility to conservatives and vice versa. That's gotten a little worse over the last 20 or 30 years, but things in Washington have gotten a lot worse. And a lot of people are wondering, why is that? Why have things changed so much in Washington?
Yeah.
And there's a new book that's going to be coming out soon. There's a really good book by a former Republican Congressman Mickey Edwards called The Parties Versus the People. And his diagnosis is the big problem is the political parties. They're like private clubs that can get enormous amounts of money, influence, and benefits when they're in the majority. But my God, when they lose the majority and they go into minority status, it's like the end of the world for them. So therefore, they fight tooth and nail. They are so bitter because if they lose, it's just terrible. So he's arguing that we got to really break things up so that the minority isn't totally shut out of power when it's in minority status in either chamber, and so that there are more relationships between these people as human beings. There's just more input from the two parties. So I think there are a lot of changes that can be made in Washington that will reduce the demonizing and allow them to find compromise in those cases where compromise would be mutually beneficial. Boy, are we in for it when it's going to be right after the election, when we're going to face another continuing resolution. How are we going to fund the nation? There's going to be another showdown, another risk of a government shutdown. So it's going to be really rough after the election. And I'm hopeful that this is going to give us the kick in the rear that we need to say, you know what, we can't keep doing this. I mean, the country is going down while a lot of Asian countries are developing, and God bless them, that's good for them. But, you know, we got to get our house in order to make it in the next century.
Yeah, we're talking to John Haidt. He's author of Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, and Kirk Karnes, executive presbyter of the Presbytery of Yukon. And we're trying to deal with the subject of morality, which is a very, very difficult one to approach in public broadcasting. They don't like to think about right and wrong very much in public broadcasting. Let's go to Joe, joins the program from Petersburg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joe.
Thank you. I just have something to say about what I think about rules, you know, as far as what we're doing as a country and how, you know, we've taken a lot of damage to our country from, say, corporations. I don't want to, you know, they're people as far as, you know, it's all of us. It's our neighbors. It's our friends. Mm-hmm. People that are in high places in different businesses that caused all of our problems. You know, they're part of our society. It's not like we can separate them out and say, oh, well, you know, the problem is it's just bigger than just a few people or just corporations or just anything. It's actually to do with our whole structure of our moral values and how we're going to deal with problems that we have. So if we get a problem and we become so divided that we can't seem to find some sort of answer that's going to help us all, then we're kind of stuck. And that's where, you know, we're so divided over these issues that, you know, I mean, myself personally feels that this guy over here shouldn't have been able to do that. And if you're not going to have rules, if we keep dropping rules because we want a free economy and a free everything, and people are going to do what they can, you know, what they want to do, well, we see what happened. You know, it seems to be part of our problem. If we don't, you know, make some sort of regulations and make people pay for the things that have happened to us as a country, it's going to continue. And 4 years from the time that the last thing happened, it's going to happen again. So
that's right, Joe. So the first is, I think I share with you, I think I'm guessing that you have generally a very positive view of capitalism and of the corporate world in general. I'm in a business school now, and I'm really coming to see that capitalism is the only system ever devised that generates vast wealth, that lifts people out of poverty. The people I meet in the corporate world generally want to do good. I have a very positive view of capitalism and of the corporate world in general. Now, what I'm learning is that different parts of the corporate world are very different. And finance, the financial world, has really differentiated. It's really gone down a different path since the 1990s, well, since the 80s, and since a lot of the deregulation began. And they have so much money, and they what they do is so hard to understand that they've been able to rewrite rules and bring enormous amounts of money to bear on the rules that they want to get for themselves, so that they can write their own rules. And what they've been able to do is rig the system so that losses are socialized. If they lose money, that those losses spread around. But if they gain money, then they and their shareholders get to keep it. So the first thing
is, I think,
we all need to differentiate between the financial world and the rest of the corporate world. The financial world is the one that's really been putting us all at risk in the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I have a corporation. I'm a small business, but you know, I produce.
Good for you. That's the backbone of society. You work hard and you take risks. And if you the odds are stacked against you, you have a good chance of failing, and no one's going to bail you out if you do. That's the way capitalism should work. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't agree with the bailout, initially because I felt, nobody ever bailed me out. I had to work and I built homes and I earned all that, I work every day and lots of hours. And for somebody to be able to come in and take the value of what I've done, basically, and cause it to take a terrible change in value is really defeating to a lot of people in our society. I mean, it hurt. We've got pension plans, and you just keep go on and on and on.
That's right. A crucial word that I think either you're looking for, or maybe you know it, is an externality. That is, when you make a business decision, if it goes south and you pay the full cost of it, that's the way things are supposed to work. That makes you very careful about your choices. But if things are set up that you can make a decision, and if it goes bad, someone else pays the cost, then you don't have to be very vigilant. That effect on others is called an externality. That is, it's an effect that is external to the person making the decision. And that's the big problem in the corporate world, is that some of these giant corporations, especially in finance, which have bought out both parties, they are able to foist great externalities on the rest of us. And not just the rest of us, the entire planet suffered because of the risks that Wall Street took.
Oh, this is so much fun. Joe in Petersburg, thanks for your call. John Haidt, we need to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted. Make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Talking about right and wrong and caring for the earth. And we've got John Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind, Why People, Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And we have Kirk Karns of One People, One Earth. And you talk about externalities, John, as we were, as you were with our caller there from Petersburg, Joe. Externalities are everywhere. I mean, Kurt, wouldn't you agree that, like, for instance, take the tar sands? They're externalizing their costs. Going into on the environment, and that's not, they don't have to pay for that part.
That's right. One of the big problems of our capitalist system is how do you bring into the cost these externalities, these things that don't just go into the automatic economic equation as you're buying it at the store. There've been a bunch of literature on it. That natural economics came out a number of years ago saying, how do we do this? How do we bring the externalities in? And we keep working on it, and it's not an easy thing to do. Our economics is built in such a way where it's very difficult to avoid externalities. And if those costs are not...
That's what government regulation, I mean,
exactly.
You know, the EPA is able to do it. The EPA passes regulations. There are various taxes, carbon taxes.
Yep.
Do you know of ways to control these externalities other than through government regulation?
No, I think government regulation is essential. And so that's one of the things that we have to work on. We've seen it be quite successful. You know, acid rain used to be such a huge problem, and it's greatly diminished over the years because of the regulation. So that's a major thing. Now we've got we need international regulation. How does that work? I don't know that one at all.
Yeah, but that's very tricky. That's right. That's extremely difficult.
Well,
and
I mean, they tried to.
Conservatives are very wary, and liberals are generally very favorably disposed.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Kyoto was an experiment, an attempt, and a reach toward international law. You know, we see right now we have a treaty over the Antarctic. And it's only science that happens there, and a little whaling here and there, and the Arctic, where it's turning into your capitalist frontier,
right?
Mm-hmm. With the sort of goofy little law of the sea thing that people may or may not choose to abide by.
Right. But I think that's one of the crucial issues is when are there international agreements that can be very well monitored and you can't cheat on? So the treaty over the Antarctic, I mean, China can't somehow – it's very hard for China to cheat on that. But if there's any sort of agreement made, some national international agreement on reducing carbon emissions, it's pretty certain that China and India are not going to honor them. And so this is one of those cases where the left might want a lot of international regulation. And for some problems, that really works. But for others, it's just a pipe dream. It's not going to work. There's some interesting people. There's a place called Breakthrough Institute, Michael Schellenberger, a couple other guys. And they take the view that, you know, we've been trying to get countries to reduce carbon emissions for a long time with no success whatsoever. The time has come to say this whole approach is just not going to work. And the only way we're going to get out of this and reduce our carbon emissions is to make other kinds of fuel so cheap that coal largely becomes uneconomical, and eventually, you know, not in the next 10, 20 years, but eventually even natural gas and tar sands. That'll take a while, but I think they might be onto something.
Well, I've looked into one thing, and that is reserves. The oil business has to have reserves. And right now, and essentially, because you take a company like ExxonMobil, and we did a show with this, they absolutely have to keep showing that they're getting more and more places where they can get oil from, even if it's a low grade, and so it heads on back down towards the lower grade deposits, which is what we're doing. It's just why the peak oil theory doesn't work, because there's lots and lots of low grade deposits. The problem is the external costs, and I don't see it would be all that hard to tweak the SEC rules about disclosure and reserves and so forth to make it so that they couldn't. That they wouldn't have that incentive anymore. I mean, that seems like almost a no-brainer. I think there's other things that we actually know how to do. We just don't have the will to do and the consensus to do. And the hardest part is getting to the consensus part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you're so handy, John.
Well, thank you. But yes, I think so. That's right. I guess to have the three of us talking about economic and regulatory policy is probably not the best use of our listeners' time. But to have us talking about the psychological obstacles to getting there—that I—that I hope I can at least be a bit more authoritative on. And part of what I see going on here is that debates over the environment, debates over global warming, there's often something else going on under the surface. Basically, the two sides don't trust each other. And what I hear, you know, I listen to Glenn Beck sometimes, and what he says is, it's not about the environment. It's about control. It's about how these liberals who hate automobiles, hate the oil industry, they just want to shut down industry. Now, that's not true about most, but there's a kernel of truth there, especially on the far left. There is a kind of what's it called, the anti-civilization movement. There's kind of some fringe anarchist groups. So there's a kernel of truth there. There's just outright hostility towards the energy industry and even towards industry. you know, what I'm hoping is that in the long run, if the two sides can sort of stop just accusing each other of being the most extreme elements on the other side, you know, oh, the right says that the left is a bunch of, you know, tree hugging anarchists, and the left says the right's a bunch of racist. They merged all together. Racist, free marketeer, Christian right. I mean, they'll just blur together all the different components. So we can get beyond the demonization and understand that actually each side is right about some very, very important threats and very, very important opportunities. Then I think there would be more goodwill for us to talk about these difficult questions about, you know, oil reserves and SEC rules and all those other things.
Yeah, that's part of your prescription. Stop attributing bad motives.
Well, and I do think that's one of the things, too, that religion brings in. When we start talking, and religion can be dangerous in this area, but it doesn't have to be. When religion comes in and says, look, we're talking about something sacred here. We're talking about the planet Earth. We're talking about caring for life. We're talking about caring for human life. And we're talking about caring for future generations. I mean, this stuff is sacred. This is stuff to be passionate about. And we can bring a common passion together and define it in such a way. One of the things that comes out of religious discussions is there's a whole lot of passion for action. Now, the strength of that is people can be very motivated for action. The danger is that we can begin demonizing folks who are of different views and of different religions. And then if we get into the demonizing, then we're just playing into havoc.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there would seem to be the Earth-friendly inclination amongst the young. I mean, it actually kind of started with the boomers, wanting to have a Prius
in the 60s,
and
yeah.
paper, not plastic, and you know, whatever the choice was, the flavor of the day. You know, now the vegans, a bunch of people want to be vegans because of ethical reasons.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes they say health, but ethical reasons. But the thing is as you point out, John, you know, the conscious part of our minds that we think is doing the deciding is like the rider on an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big old elephant, and the conscious part of us justifies and is the PR person and the press agent for the elephant.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So that's the first part of my book, is that intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. So our minds judge instantly and quickly. If you know, think about how you find whether you find a woman or a man attractive, you don't think about, well, on the one hand she's got this feature, on the other hand she's got that feature. You just know. You just instantly judge. And you know, our moral judgments are very similar. And then
once the elephant,
afterwards.
Yeah, once the
and
elephant
this is
moving,
it's so hard for us to convince each other because we're sort of it's like the my rider is arguing with your rider. The rider is the conscious reasoning stuff, but really it's the elephants that are in charge, and the elephants don't change just because I throw some reasons at you.
And so basically, the rider is the last one to tell the elephant where to go, but actually, some other rider might be much more efficient.
I'm not sure whether it's very hard to change anyone. I mean, anybody who has kids, you try to change your kids. I mean, boy, that is pretty tough, and you've got a lot of power over them. It's pretty hard to change anyone else, just one person to one person.
There's experiments
change,
that people if people people cheat and they know there's a chance they're going to get caught, they're less likely to cheat. For instance,
that's right. So you can change the environment a little bit, and then you can change behavior quite a lot. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just trying to get there. That's all. Kurt?
You know, Jonathan, I did get through your book this weekend when I figured out I was going to be on this show, so I appreciated the book greatly.
Thank you.
And part of what you were talking about as you were speaking about the elephant and the rider, the elephant being intuition, I think you would agree with this. It seems to me that paying attention to my emotions is really helpful because the emotions tell me what I really believe down deep, maybe the unconscious beliefs that I haven't brought to the surface. Why am I feeling the way that I feel about something so passionately? And it might take me a while to move to the rationality behind it, the beliefs behind it. But the passion is there because of a deeply held belief, and that's that guides my intuition. Does that sound right to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that's right. So this is the paradox we face, is that action, with people who take action, who do something, they tend not to be driven just by cool reasoning. They tend to be driven by passion.
Exactly.
But at the same time, those passions make it hard for us to think clearly and to think in a nuanced way. So you get activists who do, you know, who change the laws in ways that they often need to be changed. You know, civil rights, women's rights. These were not brought to us by philosophers sitting there coolly reasoning. These were brought to us by people who were angry or who were sympathetic. So, you know, oftentimes the activists are on the side of the angels, and they win eventually. But at the same time, often you have the passions of one side pitted against the passions of the other, and it makes it very difficult for us to understand each other, talk to each other. And that's the situation we're in. Should the government play a larger role in caring for people or a smaller role? Do we need to focus on increasing our competitiveness or protecting our environment? I mean, not that it's necessarily a trade-off. I'm just saying, the two sides are the two parties. The two sides are at loggerheads over some very fundamental questions about the direction of the country.
John Haidt, University. It's New York University. Author of The Righteous Mind, Why People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. His website is www.yourmorals.org. It's a very interesting experiment that continues to go on at that website as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Providence Imaging Center, with three locations, including its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, and digital X-rays to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com.
We're talking about our notions of right and wrong and caring for the earth and where it fits in. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and time's a-wastin'. One from Bob by email saying, look, why is the issue of perpetual growth on a finite planet something every party and corporation refuses to address? At the start of the Industrial Revolution in 1800, we had a billion people on the planet. Now we passed 7 billion in the blink of an eye. And we not only don't discuss growth, all our economic systems insist on it. So it's enough to drive a person to nihilism.
I agree. It is really scary. Obviously, the growth of the population is one of the biggest drivers of environmental degradation, and we see the cases of countries that are shrinking, and we think, look at them. You know, Japan, Italy, they're in big trouble. So we are kind of trapped. We have been in a growth trap. I don't really know what we're going to do. I mean, demographics is destiny. It does look as though as countries get wealthy. And women get liberated to pursue careers as they like, the birth rate drops. And so in the developed world, the population is going to soon be going down. I think in the long run, it's possible that population will stabilize and begin to drop. But it's going to be a very painful process, especially financially, fiscally. All of our budgets are going to go broke as is happening. Our entitlement spending can't really support aging population. So I don't know what we're going to do.
So we see we got a guy in a courtroom in Anchorage today. He's probably undergoing cross-examination, and he's sitting up there, and he sat up there in Fairbanks and decided that there was going to be a huge economic collapse, and I better get my people together and get my guns together so that we can maintain order when everything goes to hell in a handbasket. Now, his timing may be a little off, but it's kind of what you're saying here, John. And Kurt, I think you kind of feel that way too.
I do think that one of the huge issues, you know, One People, One Earth is focusing on the climate change issue. So one of the questions we ask ourselves is, why is it hard to get people really to act on a passion on this? Part of it is it's such a huge problem that it's frightening to think of taking on something of that scale. And, I mean, what do you do? So do you get your guns ready for when the collapse happens and you just hunker down in a fortress? Well, that's that doesn't seem like a real positive mindset to live out of, and probably not a healthy way to live. So what do we do? And that I do think that becomes one of the things that holds us back.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. There are some kinds of crises that recruit, they recruit the psychological mechanisms that will basically solve them. And so a foreign attack is one. If you're attacked, 9/11, what does it do? Well, one thing it does is it makes people want to sign up for the military. It makes us, how many of us got in line to give blood on that terrible day? So a foreign attack triggers a very constructive response to deal with it. But a gradually rising global temperature, carbon dioxide, especially when it's not something where we can simply control it ourselves, but in fact the Chinese now emit more emissions than we do, these are problems that are very, very difficult to solve without some sort of global agreement. But as I said before, it's very difficult to get any sort of global agreement in which China and India are actually going to follow the rules. I mean, even the Europeans, found various ways to, skirt or misidentify their baselines in the various earlier protocols. So again, my hope here is ultimately that technology will produce forms of energy that will become so cheap that we can move away from carbon finally. I think we should be investing massively. I mean, it's the Obama administration has invested in green energy, and some of those investments have been bad investments, so it's very hard to sell this. But I don't see a way forward other than technology saving us on this one.
I do think that's one of the issues, too, is if we try something and it doesn't go well, it might not mean it's a bad idea, like investing in green energy.
That's right.
But if we do it poorly, we may just get inoculated enough against it that we don't want it anymore.
Yeah.
And that can be hard on the system.
Well, I'm fascinated by this idea of a threat. I think there's a science fiction, I can't remember, where there's an invasion by the aliens. But it's been faked by somebody, by people that want to save the Earth. But they convince everybody, and everybody bands together. They do all the things they needed to do all along, banish war and, so forth. And
that's right. That's the fantasy. On the day the Martians actually arrive, we'll probably solve a lot of our problems.
Well, I follow scientific issues a great deal. I was at the American Association for the Advancement of Science when the first session happened on sociobiology, and people in the crowd saying.
When E.O. Wilson was so harshly criticized and almost attacked.
Oh, you wouldn't believe what happened in the room. People were saying, this is racist. This can't possibly be. I mean, what are you even having? It was amazing. And my most recent science adventure was looking into the International Polar Year and talking to the people who wrote the report that nobody's read. And these are scientists who, they went there. They saw. They saw the ice shelves crumbling in Antarctica. They see what's happening in the Arctic Ocean and what the actual implications of the big lens of fresh water and the productivity and so forth. They see it. They just don't know how to make it sound urgent enough.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because it's gradually creeping, and I think that there are organized groups funded in part by the coal and oil industry that are very expert in sowing doubt, and this is what some groups learned with the controversies over creationism versus evolution in the 90s, is that if you have a lobby, you give money to some lobby group that manufactures controversy and finds some third-rate scientist who says, well, there's actually doubt on this, then suddenly there's a controversy, and the press says, oh, we've got to teach both sides.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we are with global warming.
Okay, we're down
there
to...
There are a few scientists. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so let's get almost down to lightning round here because we're winding up the show. Keith and Chugiak, welcome to Talk of Alaska with John Haidt and Kirk Carnes.
Hello there. How are you today?
Great.
Good. Glad to hear it. Interesting show. I'd just like to throw in my two cents about, the conservative-liberal divide, and it seems that... this was really accelerated in the early Bush years, starting with the deregulation of energy, to where speculators on Wall Street and Enron could reap mass profits. And from that point on, since it decimated so many people's lives, the emotional ness of the issue has grown exponentially. And then come the end of the Bush years, the Tea Party emerges, and they're complaining about their outrage over the war that we're wasting all this money on and not about the lives that have been lost since it had started in a senseless illegal war. And then they pile on, you know, the Glenn Beck-isms and the Sarah Palin-isms, where, you know, Sarah Palin wouldn't have been anywhere but for bipartisan cooperation in this state. And then she came out as the holy mother of all conservatives. And they've gone out of their way to create this environment that we're living in today. You can't turn on the news without having it piled on you all the time.
So I would agree with you that when that George Bush is going to go down in history as one of the worst presidents we've ever had, really the wrong man for the time, a man who made some really terrible decisions that took us from a position of budgetary balance and world respect into the opposite. And the deregulate, you know, obviously he and Cheney were very, very favorable to the energy industry, a lot of deregulation there. The one place I would disagree with you, though, is to say that everything was Bush's fault, and that Clinton, much as I like the man, not just personally, but I think he was a very good president in most ways, but when you look at the history of what happened with the financial crisis, a couple of the biggest events happened under Clinton's watch.
The
Wall Street and the ending of the Glass-Steagall and the failure to regulate derivatives, even though the experts recommended it. So both parties are heavily influenced by Wall Street money in particular.
You can do broadcast.
Sort of let the genie out of the bottle.
Broadcast deregulation started under Jimmy Carter. You can go back that far. And there's been one bubble after another, telecom bubble, real estate bubble. The Enron bubble was just one of those bubbles. But
to prevent industries from being and a few rich guys from being able to say, here, look, here's $10 million. I'm going to spend this to get the laws changed for my industry. I mean, this should not be happening in our country, but it happens all the time, and we all pay the cost. It's externalities foisted on all of us.
So now you're going to be teaching ethics to MBAs, there, John, huh?
I don't think you can teach ethics. I'm going to be teaching them how to set up their businesses so that they get better ethical outcomes. I'm not going to try to stick ethics into their head because that can't be done.
Wow. Well, I wish you well, and I thank you so much for being on the program today.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve. This is a really fun, freewheeling conversation, and thank you, Kurt, too.
Yeah, it's been fun.
It was wheeling really, really free. And we got an email from Kent here. It says, good morning. In today's discussion, you state it's hard to cheat on the Antarctic Treaty. As a participant in the USAP in the past 14 years, I suggest it depends on how you define cheat. Natural resources are being exploited, tracked, explored, trapped, mapped, and many countries are preparing to exploit what may be the largest oil discovery in the world at the end of the treaty. It never ends!
Okay. It never ends.
Okay, then I stand correct. I had no expertise on that. I'm sorry. I was wrong.
I'm the one that said it. You're fine, okay. John. All right. Thank you much. Kurt Kearns, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
All right. Josh Edge. And Dave Waldron. Bye.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.